Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories. You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Checking Valley traffic on the 60 eastbound. A crash at State Route 87 blocks the intersection. An Arizona Senate committee this afternoon is expected to take up a bill that would set up the do's and don'ts for drones in the state. Up until now, the issue had mostly been decided on the city or town level. State Senator John Kavanaugh is the main sponsor of Senate Bill 1449. Senator Kavanaugh, why do this on the statewide level?
Yeah, I mean, each individual city having their own rules and regulations invites chaos, conflicting laws, and many of them will inadvertently violate federal law because the FAA preempts a lot of state and local regulation on any kind of aircraft, and drones are included there. This bill originated because Amazon and Google, the people who expect to be doing deliveries of merchandise by drones in the near future, were very alarmed as city after city in Arizona began passing or considering their own laws. So we have a big stakeholders group. We have the industry people here. We have League of Cities and Towns there. Law enforcement is there. And we're putting together a bill that would preempt local regulation, but in the state bill would have addressed the concerns of localities to the extent that we can with the FAA.
Well, how are you trying to approach that balance between business interests, privacy interests, law enforcement interests, a lot of interests here?
Well, and don't forget the fourth interest, which is the FAA. The FAA precludes a lot of regulation here. However, even they admit that they're way behind the curve on drones, which is a new and developing technology. So they're scrambling to get their rules in place. And we've been in contact with them to see just how far we can go. I mean, basically, industry wants to be able to make their deliveries without unnecessary and conflicting regulations. And the cities and towns are very much concerned about the privacy issues surrounding drones. They don't want people flying drones with cameras and over people's backyards and peeking into windows. And law enforcement is very concerned about drones not being used for criminal purposes, obviously. They're also concerned about their being able to use drones when they have warrants and what have you for surveillance. The fire people are worried about forest fire operations shutting down because drones are flying where the tanker planes are flying the fire retardant in. And we've also had problems with people flying drones over prisons and correctional facilities and dropping contraband or weapons. And then the utilities are worried about drones around critical infrastructure like nuclear power plants and large power stations where there could be sabotage or terrorists could be staking it out. So almost everybody has a potential problem that we're trying to address with drones.
Have you found it a tough slog to try to address all of those issues while making sure that people aren't, you know, having drones fly next to their windows, or law enforcement can do what they need to do and not have other people do what law enforcement doesn't want them to do? I mean, is this an easy thing to get all this together?
Well, it's not as difficult as it would seem because there's general agreement on everybody's side that we can't be overly burdensome in regulation, but we need to protect people's privacy. Of course, the great question mark is where the FAA will eventually fall on this issue, and we may have to do some changes when they start to tighten theirs up.
How close do you think you are to having final language for a bill?
Oh, I think we're like within a week away. I'm sure when it gets to the House, there may be a few minor tweaks. But they've been working for about a month now, and they've ironed out most of the issues.
And as you suggested, this might not be the last word on this. Would you expect that at some point, maybe next year or the year after, or some point down the road, you'll have to revisit this and maybe make a few small or maybe even some big changes?
I think you'll see some small changes, probably driven mostly by the FAA, which might tighten up its regulation and preclude more of what we might be doing.
State Senator John Kavanaugh is the sponsor of Senate Bill 1449, which would set up statewide regulations for the use of drones. The bill is scheduled to be heard in the Senate Transportation Committee this afternoon. The area in and around the Pinal County city of Eloy, around 60 miles southeast of Phoenix, is sinking. A lot. Joining me to talk about how much and why is Mike Conway. He's the chief of the Geologic Extension Service at the Arizona Geological Survey in Tucson. And Mike, what's going on?
Well, the basin floor has been subsiding for a number of years. Agriculture is a big part of the economy in the Eloy area in the Picacho Basin. And as groundwater is tapped off from that underground aquifer, the ground begins to subside as the sediments get closer and closer together. So there's been some substantial subsidence in Eloy over the past 65, 70 years or so, on the order of several tens of feet.
And that's something that people would notice.
It would happen, you know, at the rate of 3 or 4 or 5 inches a year when it was really happening at a high rate. Now the rate is probably less than that. So while you notice it over the long term or over the middle term, medium term, you might not notice it day to day, month to month, or even year to year.
Is this something that is unexpected for this area, given, as you say, the reliance on agriculture and groundwater?
Yeah, no, it's not. Actually, subsidence occurs pretty much in many different places around the country, and where groundwater is a big component of the agricultural industry. So we see even more extreme cases in California.
Other than the fact that the Earth is getting a little bit lower, are there other potential negative consequences of this happening?
Well, one of the things that happens along the fringe, the outer fringe or perimeter of the basin, is we see earth fissures developing. And these are long, extensive cracks that form as the basin subsides rather heterogeneously. So most of the subsidence occurs in the central part of the basin. And so along the edges of the basin, the subsidence isn't as great. It sets up some tensional forces that results in these earth fissures developing, and they can be very damaging to infrastructure and to property.
How so?
Well, they're large, extended fractures in the unconsolidated sediments that make up the ground surface there. They can be anywhere between hundreds of feet to miles in length. They have a tendency to develop gullies, so sometimes some of them are 15 or 20 or even 30 feet deep and maybe 10 or 15 feet across.
Have you seen this kind of subsidence in other parts of the state?
Oh yeah, there's a number of basins here in the south central and southeastern part of Arizona where we see subsidence. I think the subsidence in Eloy is a little more dramatic than in most locales. I forget the number off the top of my head. It may be as much as 20 or 25 feet over the last 75 years or so. That's a lot of subsidence.
Do you think that over time other areas will have that much subsidence as the Eloy area has had?
Well, it's a function of how much groundwater they take out of their aquifer and how rapidly it comes out of that aquifer. As you remove the groundwater, the aquifer sediments compact together and the basin simply begins to subside.
Is it possible to reverse the subsidence if you pump either water back in or some other substance back into the ground? Will it go back up?
Well, that's a great question, and there probably would be some reinflation of the base sediment basins, but a lot of times it's the clays that are compacted close together, and clays would be very hard to inflate. So we might anticipate seeing some expansion and perhaps some reduction in the overall subsidence, but I don't know that you'd anticipate that the surface would come back to its original level.
Mike Conway is chief of the Geologic Extension Service at the Arizona Geological Survey in Tucson. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, 60 eastbound, a crash at State Route 87 blocks the intersection. Also on the 17 northbound, a collision at Bell Road has the shoulder blocked. Well, if you like near record high temperatures, you're going to love today. Sunny skies with a high forecast of 90 degrees. The record for today, 84 degrees, set just last year. We've in fact reached that now. 71 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 50s. Sunny and even warmer tomorrow with a high of 92 degrees. It's 2:20 at KJZZ. The death of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia leaves the High Court shorthanded, and the reluctance of Republican senators to confirm a replacement nominated by President Obama could mean more rulings from lower courts, including the Ninth Circuit, stand. Joining me to explain all this is Professor Paul Bender of the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. And Paul, could the vacancy impact some Arizona-based cases?
Yeah, it could, depending upon what the vote is in the Supreme Court. If the court's unanimous, then the fact that there's one less justice doesn't make any difference. But if the court is split 5-4 and would be split 5-4 except for one of the justices, one of the five not being there, then that changes it from a decision that the five wanted to an affirmance by an equally divided court. So depending upon what the vote is in the court, or what the vote would be, and they're both are possible here because some of those cases have already been argued and voted on, and the court has reached a tentative result. And if Scalia is in the majority, and if the majority is 5, so it's a 5-4 case, now Scalia can no longer participate in that case. The result would be changed from what the 5 wanted to do to an automatic affirmance by an equally divided court.
We've heard a lot about the redistricting case that the Supreme Court has taken up as one that would potentially could potentially be impacted by Justice Scalia's death. Are there others that are on your radar coming from Arizona that could be impacted by a shorthanded court?
I don't know that there are others coming from Arizona, but there are other cases that the court has on its docket that could be impacted. To put it in general terms, although it is a little confusing, the cases that will be impacted are cases that, if Scalia had participated, had been able to participate, would have been a 5-4 decision with Scalia part of the five justice majority. Those cases would be impacted if that 5-4 decision were going to be a reversal of the decision below, because that reversal would be turned into a 4-4 tie. And when the court is 4-4 in a tie, it affirms by an equally divided court. If the court were going to affirm anyway in a 5-4 decision, then Scalia's leaving would not change the result. It would still be an affirmance, but the court doesn't write opinions in 4-4 cases. And so the case would go from one where there would be an opinion affirming to one where there would be just a summary affirmance. Now, that's if the court goes ahead and decides those cases. The court has the option of, depending again upon the vote, if they feel it's better not to hand the case down as a 4-4 affirmance without an opinion, they can set the case over for re-argument next term and wait until they have 9 justices and then have the case re-argued and decided with a full complement of 9. The problem with that for the court is they don't know when there's going to be a 9th justice. And so to put these cases over, they would do it at the end of the term. They have a bunch of 4-4 cases that they'd rather wait. How long do they have to wait? You can't even schedule the arguments for next fall because there probably won't be a 9th justice next fall. So to put the case over for a year and a half, that's something different. The court, as far as I know, has never been in that position where they would have a bunch of cases, you know, 3 or 4, which they would want to have re-argued, and they don't know when they could have the re-argument because they don't know when the vacancy is going to be filled. That puts the court in quite a difficult position.
ASU Law Professor Paul Bender. Paul, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Pope Francis is midway through his journey across Mexico. By tomorrow, he'll be in Ciudad Juarez, a city with deep wounds that go as far back as the Mexican Revolution. Today, the city is recovering from a brutal drug war that left more than 10,000 people dead. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Monica Ortiz Uribe reports that in Juarez, Pope Francis will continue calling attention to people on the margins.
Pope Francis will start his day here at the state prison in Ciudad Juarez. In less than 10 years, it's been the site of 2 deadly riots sparked by rival gangs that serve as foot soldiers to Mexico's most powerful drug cartels. But state government reforms have started turning things around. Since January, inmates have been busy reconstructing a chapel where the Pope will address 700 prisoners and their families. Joel Torres has been locked up for 15 years, convicted of a murder he committed while serving in the Mexican military. In my past, it was easier to believe in a rifle than it was to believe in God, he says. Now Torres has reconnected with his faith and is preparing to recover his freedom in about a year. New programs give prisoners here the opportunity to finish school, play sports, or get job training. People on the outside should know that we're capable of reintegrating ourselves into society, he says. Torres feels the Pope's visit gives them a sense of validation. You can be overcome with sadness in this place, he says, but now that the Pope is coming, we're all overjoyed.
En el nombre del Padre, del Hijo, del Espíritu Santo. Amen.
Across town, a grieving mother recites a prayer in the house where her son was murdered 6 years ago. We're in the neighborhood of Villas de Salvarcar, site of a now infamous massacre where gunmen killed 16 people at a teenager's birthday party. It marked the beginning of one of the most violent years in Juarez history. Our pain continues, our anger continues, and the injustice continues, says Blanca Estela Camargo. She's among the countless victims of violence across Mexico that Pope Francis will pay tribute to at a mass near the border fence. It's expected to draw 200,000 people. We hope the Pope's blessing will bring us some consolation, Camargo says. She also hopes his visit will highlight what she believes to be the root of the city's problems. It all starts with poverty and hunger, she says. Without opportunities, people will continue to turn to crime and easy money. At a migrant shelter run by the Juarez Diocese, Roberto Jimenez builds a new message board for the community room. 14 years ago, he left his native Nicaragua for the United States, only he never made it. I stayed at this very shelter and got robbed, he says. Unable to pay a smuggler to take him the last 10 miles of his trip, Jimenez started doing carpentry work for the diocese. That's when he was struck by Cupid's arrow. It was love at first sight, says Rita Reynaldo. She's Jimenez's wife. They met at a church where he was working. When she agreed to be his girlfriend, he knew his journey had ended. The two have found happiness in Juarez. She's a school teacher, and he continues to work as a carpenter. I'm very proud that my husband is an immigrant, Reynaldo says. Immigration is the overarching theme of Pope Francis's visit to Mexico. It will conclude in Juarez, long recognized as a city of migrants. Francis is expected to walk to the invisible line that separates Mexico from the U.S. There, he'll kneel at the dusty bank of the Rio Grande and pray. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, Ciudad Juarez.
Lift the embargo, President Obama said in his final State of the Union address. He was referring to the decades-old U.S. embargo against Cuba. This week, the U.S. government has given the go-ahead for the first American-owned factory to be built in Cuba in more than half a century. A small Alabama-based company aims to build an assembly plant for low-cost tractors designed for the needs of small private farms. And more changes do seem to be coming ever since Cuban President Raul Castro eased the rules on private enterprise. The Cuban town of Trinidad is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and has long attracted visitors from around the world. The BBC's Will Grant went to see the changes and found a communist town now built on private ownership.
Even when the temperatures drop in Cuba, the nights in Trinidad are still warm and muggy. On a rooftop restaurant, a band plays to diners and holidaymakers as they eat. It's a common enough scene in the colonial town, but one that also uniquely captures the changes taking place in Cuba. Everyone, from the restaurant owners to the waiters, chefs, and even the musicians themselves, works in the private sector. Trinidad is normally a tranquil place, but these days the background noise is the constant banging and drilling of construction. It seems anyone with a little extra space is renovating it into rooms for tourists, one of the few private enterprises permitted under Raul Castro. Trinidad looks like the resort town of Varadero, jokes Oreste, a builder who runs a private subcontracting firm with his friend Jose. Business is brisk, they tell me. But Oreste says it's not just builders in Trinidad benefiting.
For ordinary people here, it's good, because if there's tourism, there's money. When there's money, everyone's happy.
It really is extraordinary. I was just talking to two construction workers. And as we were chatting, a tour guide with tourists on horseback came past, also a private business.
During the special period, after the collapse of the Soviet bloc, there began a very, very difficult period for all of Cuba, including Trinidad.
I tracked down the city's historian, Dr. Manuel Lagunilla, to ask how Trinidad reached this point. He immediately pointed to the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The only solution, which I consider a very intelligent decision by Fidel's leadership, was tourism. There was no other choice. The sugar industry began to fold, and there was no alternative. We were on our own in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a cobbled plaza, a street theatre troupe performs outside the gallery of local artist Yami Martinez. Yami is one of the main entrepreneurs in Trinidad, running three small businesses, a family restaurant, a bed and breakfast, and her gallery.
With this boom in private enterprise, a range of incredible businesses has opened up. People have opened up some beautiful restaurants, staying faithful to the aesthetic of the town and its architecture.
Oh man, this way, better play here, this way.
There are now private businesses on every corner and three different street markets. Many in Trinidad don't even abandon their state jobs. They simply get the license to become self-employed as well.
How many rooms do you have?
Seis habitaciones tenemos. Six.
The most popular choice of self-employment is to set up a casa particular or hostel, though fewer of the standard of La Casona. Built in an old hacienda on the outskirts of Trinidad, the boutique hotel is run by Kenya Ponce and her husband. Kenya says there is now an interdependence of private jobs in the town.
Many people have opened small and medium-sized restaurants, little cafeterias, and many have turned their homes into spaces for rent. And that's what the people of Trinidad live on.
In this historic town, tourism is certainly sustaining private enterprise, but private businesses are keeping the tourism trade afloat too.
That's Will Grant from our partners at the BBC reporting from Cuba. In KJZZ News, Arizona's Child Welfare Agency isn't the only state government department that's facing a severe backlog in its workload. As KJZZ's Phil Latsman reports, a new report indicates inspections and investigations in other critical areas are falling behind as well.
The Arizona Capital Times reports inspections for nearly half the X-ray facilities in the state are overdue, repairs on state highways undone, and cases involving teacher misconduct and elderly abuse untouched. The problem with the X-ray inspections is one that Arizona's Auditor General says puts the public at risk. The auditor also stated that ADOT was falling behind on road maintenance projects, and it estimates road repair delays have cost state motorists an extra $1.5 billion in car repairs. A more recent backlog to gain attention is the rape testing kit, which Governor Doug Ducey has made a priority to make current. In addition, the state faces a heavy logjam in its child abuse and neglect cases, which stand at roughly 13,000, with little progress made recently. Phil Latsman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, February 16th. Thanks for listening. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. The final battle for Aleppo in Syria may have begun.
It really is horrific, really, to be honest. I mean, we haven't seen this volume of attacks since the war began in a single day.
That's Juliet Tuma, regional spokesman for UNICEF, speaking to reporters on Monday about airstrikes in northern Syria that have destroyed healthcare facilities and schools, produced tens of thousands of refugees. A Doctors Without Borders hospital has been destroyed. 50 civilians have been killed. The attacks are happening in a window negotiated as part of a ceasefire, recently brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, a ceasefire supposed to take effect at the end of the week, long window. Senator John McCain says the Russians are just using this week-long window to take advantage of the ceasefire deal.
Mr. Putin is not interested in being our partner. He wants to shore up the Assad regime. He wants to reestablish Russia as a major power in the Middle East. He wants to use Syria as a live fire exercise for Russia's modernizing military.
But in the confused open-season military environment in Syria right now, it has been difficult to confirm the source of these latest attacks. Russia has been blamed, though that has yet to be confirmed, and the Russians are denying it. But there's no doubt that aid convoys promised in the ceasefire agreement have yet to arrive in Syria. Robert Ford served as U.S. ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014. He's also a fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Ambassador Ford, what do you make of this entire situation and this week-long window that has produced this escalation right after the ceasefire talks in Munich?
The Russians have been escalating their military operations in Syria for many weeks now, so they're just on a current escalation track. They have been explicit. They have been explicit that even after the so-called ceasefire were to come into effect, they will continue to bomb what they call our terrorists, and they say that any armed group in the Aleppo area, any armed group fighting the Syrian government, are terrorists. So it's hard to see how there's going to be a cessation to Russian airstrikes, and therefore it's hard to see how there's going to be a ceasefire.
I don't understand what the U.S. tactical approach would be here, because Putin seems to be saying explicitly or implicitly that the way to fight ISIS is to reestablish the Assad government. Once we do that, then we'll go after ISIS. That violates a principle that the Obama administration has already said, that we want some kind of regime change in Damascus. And then what of all these other opposition groups that we're supposed to be arming and sending money to? If you listen to the Republican candidates, we've spent billions on people that now the Russians are going to destroy from airstrikes.
I'm not sure we've spent billions, but we certainly have provided arms and assistance to a few of the armed groups, including some that the Russians are now bombing in northern Syria. But we need to understand what the Russians want. What the Russians want is for the armed opposition to surrender to Bashar al-Assad's government. That's what they want. They have focused somewhere between 70 and 80% of their airstrikes not on the Islamic State, but rather on other rebel opposition groups. So the Russian target is clear. They want to get the armed opposition to quit the battle, to either surrender or just go away, go back into Turkey or something.
Is it possible that this is a decent strategy? I mean, nothing has worked so far against ISIS that the U.S. and the coalition has attempted to do. Maybe, you know, shifting gears and restoring Assad is the best way to fight ISIS.
I don't think the Syrian opposition is ever going to surrender. And we've had now 4 years where Bashar al-Assad could have mobilized enough Syrians to go fight the Islamic State, and he has failed to do so. He doesn't have enough people fighting for him. That's why Iran is organizing Shia militias from places like Iraq and Afghan refugee camps to go fight for Assad on the Syrian battlefield. Assad does not really have enough troops, doesn't have enough Syrian troops to go fight the Islamic State. So consolidating Bashar al-Assad in Damascus is one thing. Having enough troops to go fight the Islamic State is a different thing.
I don't know if you looked at the latest National Geographic magazine, but there are these outrageous pictures of the paradise that the Kurds have created in Erbil and in northern Iraq. And of course, they're fighting, the Peshmerga is fighting in Syria to try to do the same thing in the Kurdish-controlled territories in Syria. Do the Kurds have the aspiration to create a kind of walled-off Kurdistan that would be basically separate from all of this other turmoil? Can they actually accomplish something like that?
Syrian Kurds, whom I've met over the years, look at the Kurdish experience in northern Iraq as a very positive experience. And I think they would like to create a similar autonomous zone. Iraqi Kurds are not fully independent, but let's say they're 85% independent. And I think Syrian Kurds on the Syrian side of the border up there in northeastern Syria, they too would like to be largely autonomous. Problem is that unlike Iraqi Kurdistan, the Syrian Kurdish areas are very heterogeneous. There are a lot of Arab tribes mixed in. There are a lot of Turkmen tribes mixed in. Even ancient Christian communities, Assyrian communities. It's not as homogeneous as it is on the Iraqi side of the border. And therefore, Syrian Kurds trying to set this up unilaterally without negotiating it with the other communities that live there with them is bound to cause ethnic and sectarian frictions.
Could that bring Turkey into a war that would have the Russians, a coalition, and now the Turks also trying to benefit the Sunnis inside Syria and fight ISIS or even support ISIS? We don't know what the Turks are up to.
Well, I don't think the Turks are supporting the Islamic State any longer. The Islamic State has carried out a number of terrorist operations inside Turkey and killed literally dozens and dozens of people in bombing attacks. But the Turks view the Kurdish issue as one that touches on their territorial integrity. That is to say, their literally their borders. They don't want Turkish Kurdish communities to link up politically with Syrian Kurdish communities. And so the Turks will be very involved in Syria, and they will be very careful about what the Syrian Kurds do.
Helping us to decipher the complex situation in Syria. Robert Ford, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ambassador Robert Ford is a former U.S. ambassador to Syria and a fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington.
That was John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. The arm of the University of Arizona that helps faculty commercialize their research is reporting more and more success. TechLaunch Arizona analyzes inventions for patentability, works with researchers to further develop the technology, and helps find a business home for it with a license that ensures the university gets some kind of royalty or other payment. David Allen is vice president for TechLaunch Arizona. And David, 2015 was a good year for you. How do you measure success?
Well, the good news about what we do is our business is very countable. And it first starts with invention disclosures. Those are the reports of inventions by faculty. We had a record number there. And then patents where we go through application and we prosecute that patent. And then we have patents that issue, and they issue 3 to 5 years later. But we also have other metrics. Some are just simply in a number of license agreements. We had 45 exclusive license agreements. That's probably double than just 2 years ago. Then we also look at the money that comes in from the royalties. That's typically a lag of anywhere from 5 to 10 years post the license.
Why do you think it is that your numbers are up as much as they are?
There's no secret, first off, that the University of Arizona did not do a very good job historically in this area. And first off, there's support at the top. It has then cascaded into the colleges, and that's one thing. But I think more than anything else, the faculty here now believe that we're here to help. We have, you know, greater resources in the past, and I think nothing is better than success begetting success.
So it sounds like you don't think that there's necessarily more or better or maybe even more commercialized research going on at the university. It's just the faculty knows that you are there and that you are able to help, and they're maybe more willing to involve you in what they're doing than they used to be.
Right. I think that, you know, the University of Arizona is a top 20 public research institution. And what we do is as good as any of those other top 20. So we do different work. We have, you know, areas of expertise that are different, and we're overrepresented, if you would, with our invention and license portfolio in those areas. But every university is going to have something that they're particularly good at. I don't think it's necessarily the mix, per se, of technologies. I think that the reason why we're doing well is that we have developed a reputation for being able to deliver.
Are other universities doing the same kind of thing to the point where you are able to compare how the U of A is doing versus other research-type universities?
Every research university has a tech transfer office. There's some differences, though, largely dependent upon a couple things. One, how many years they've been doing it. A second is how much support there is for it. A third is what kind of community the university is located in. For example, Stanford in Silicon Valley, MIT in Boston. Those are the two, you know, technology centers of the world. So what we do to supplement what we have in the community is we've been able to build our network through our alumni base. And those kind of people are technology-curious people. They want to hear what's happening at the university, the next thing. And they want to hear it from their own university.
David Allen is the Vice President for Tech Launch Arizona, the commercialization arm of the University of Arizona. February is Black History Month, but history is not always easy to track down and get right, especially for African Americans, whose family history is often obscured by hundreds of years of slavery. The show's Annika Klein tells us about the digging it takes to fill in the details.
If you want to meet your ancestors, start with the major life events.
The marriage certificate, I would consider to be a primary source of information.
Joyce McCollum is president of the Black Family Genealogy and History Society, a Phoenix genealogical research group. She's presenting at their monthly meeting, telling members how to use basic records to trace their ancestry.
You'll find death records and you'll find wills at the county courthouse or the city courthouse level.
But McCollum says even finding the basics can be difficult when tracing an African-American lineage.
We did not appear on census records as individuals, as citizens, until 1870.
That was the first census taken after the 13th Amendment was ratified, formally abolishing slavery. McCollum calls this the 1870 brick wall, and there are many other walls these researchers confront, big and small. The advice McCollum gives is specific to these challenges.
You have a huge amount of marriages of African American people in the years 1866 through 1868.
Unions before that time weren't legally documented, so there are no marriage licenses to uncover. Despite these obstacles, the group gathered here hopes to uncover their family histories. What McCollum calls filling in the dash on the tombstone. You start with the birth and death dates, and then you look for the good stuff, the stuff that happened in between.
He was a Purple Hoarder, and I just bought these along just to... His Purple Heart medals and all, and his sharpshooting medals and all that.
That's Kathy Ayers. She's talking about her grandfather as she casually pulls out his Purple Heart medal. She says she has a lot of memorabilia from him.
I have a big sword of his that he claimed he killed several men with when he was out here in Arizona.
She didn't bring the sword, but we took her word for it. Another member, Camila Shabazz, hopes to trace her ancestry back to Africa.
I'm a native. I was born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona.
But even just finding her roots in the South has been hard. So Shabazz went there herself. She says getting your own boots on the ground is better than a long-distance phone call.
I found my great-great-grandfather, who was Jordan King. He served in the Civil War. Now I'm unable to find my great-grandmother's grave in Louisiana, so that's a challenge.
Cemeteries come up a lot in the group discussion. Members mourn the graves that have been lost under new construction, and they discuss how to save what's still there. For a group that aims to uncover history, there's actually a lot of talk about the future. Here's Joyce McCollum again, addressing the group.
Part of our responsibility is not just to research and record and document our family history, but to do others' history as well, preservation.
The group hopes to continue to fill in the blank spaces in African American histories, to show future generations where they came from. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
What does an art museum do when it suspects one of its works is a fake? In the case of the ASU Art Museum, it turns that into an exhibit. Superflex, Superfake the Parlay involves the Danish artist collective Superflex and looks at a questionable painting in the museum's collection, allegedly by Frederick Remington. As it turns out, the piece is a copy of Remington's work called The Parlay. To talk about the fake and the exhibit, I met up with Julio Cesar Morales at the ASU Art Museum. He's a curator there. And I asked him if the piece is what people thought it was.
It is and it's not. And essentially, this is a painting that's in question from the museum. This was acquired by the first collector that actually began the museum. You can call him the founder, James B. Oliver. And so he bought this painting in, I believe, 1951. And this painting, titled Pioneer and Indian, is supposed to be painted in 1903.
It seems like this is kind of a perfect example of a teachable moment. I mean, you have a museum that has a piece of art that may or may not be real. Instead of sort of shying away from it, you say, okay, let's talk about this.
Right, and at the same point, again, Superflex is really interested in the value of art, the emotional value of art. If you had seen this work for the last 40 years, what does it mean now that it's a fake?
Is there a concern in the art world that we pay too much attention to authenticity and financial value as opposed to the aesthetic value or the emotional value or just the artistic value of a piece?
I think that's definitely true. You know, sometimes I see people coming into museums and they're more interested in the piece if the name Warhol appears, or they know that this piece is worth $5 million, $10 million. And so that's one of the interesting factors within the exhibition.
So how do you go about talking about that? I mean, I would imagine this is a fairly sensitive subject in the art world. So how do you plan a whole exhibit about basically fraud?
It's a nice way of putting it. Well, you know, we went through the process with Superflex in regards to when a painting or an artwork is authenticated, whether it's a fake or real, you have to go through certain steps.
Has technology helped make that easier? I mean, is it easier now for museums and other art experts to say, yes, this is a real Remington versus no, it's not?
We ended up collaborating with the Solid State Science Program, and we ended up using this cutting-edge device that is called an I-beam that basically shoots atoms through a laser, and it basically penetrates the painting and it comes back into a computer and it reads the levels of material within the painting itself. And for example, they can detect if someone was smoking as the painting was being created.
What was it about this piece in particular that led you guys to say, yeah, this isn't it?
Well, one of the things was the connoisseurship, which is basically we brought in an expert, Jim Ballinger, who was the director of the Phoenix Art Museum for 30 years, and he's an expert in Western art and in Remington. And so he came in, and he was one of the first people in 1992 to write a letter to our senior curator, Heather Limeberry, and mentioned that I don't think this really is a Remington.
Has this experience and this exhibit caused you to look at pretty much every other piece that you have in this museum and examine, is this what we think it is?
Yes, and you know, ever since then, in those letters in the 90s, there were a couple other paintings in question, which actually you can see here in the exhibition as well. So these markings you see on the wall are these kind of phantasmagoric markings of where the paintings were. And we left the Remington exactly where it was in the previous exhibition, removed all the other paintings, and you can actually see the markings on the wall, and we kept the labels of the actual artwork indicators.
What do you hope that people who come to see this exhibit will take away from it?
I think in a way to erase monetary value to the painting and to something that just touches you in that sense. So if you really are engrossed in a painting, it shouldn't matter who made it. It doesn't matter if it's worth $5 million or $500. So I think that's one of the objectives of this exhibition. And I mean, the other element of the exhibition that's interesting is that Remington created this kind of mythology of the West. So in a way, those paintings are also a construction. And so it's hard to tell what is real, what is not real, because his studio was in New York. But he came to the West, took photographs, and read the newspaper and created these paintings. So then again, even if it's authentic or not authentic, what about the actual meaning or the actual subjects in the painting? Is that a real experience? Is that something that really happened?
Even his authentic paintings might not have been authentic events.
Exactly, and that's part of the project.
Julio Cesar Morales is a curator at the ASU Art Museum. We were talking about the exhibit Superflex, Superfake the Parlay, which will be on display until the end of April. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.